After 25 years in the fashion industry, I've realized that fashion is not really about the clothes, it's about the people. I'm Laura Van Root Poole, and this is What We Wore. Rupert Sanderson is an independent shoemaker who began his career in advertising, but always had a hunch he'd one day make shoes. I'm one of his first clients, and now he's been in business for over 20 years. We spoke to Rupert on his day off, gathering inspiration at a bookshop in Notting Hill. I'm glad to see you, even though I'm used to seeing you back in the day in small hotel rooms, which sounds more nefarious than it is.
Yes, I remember it well. Those are the days.
I know. I've been carrying the collection that long, probably 15 years. I don't know how long.
It was pre-Andrew. Possibly.
Yeah, I think it was just with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
Well, I suppose I'd say London. Well, I grew up all over the place. I'm born in Penang in Malaysia. And then, I was a sort of, son of an army, son of a soldier. So, we just moved around from Germany, the Far East to, UK. So, yeah, it was sort of a fairly peripatetic existence.
Were you one of many siblings? Did you have siblings?
I had one sister, 2 years younger than me. I went to school, went to boarding school in the UK. Yes. It's a lot of traveling. Actually, both sides of my family come from Cambridge, which is in East Anglia, which is, one of those university towns. So that's, I suppose, where I sort of come from. But I spent, however many years now, 35 years in London, probably 40 years in London.
What do you remember about growing up in Penang and how? Why was that? Was it influential?
The truth is, it was a very short period of time because I was only there for about 6 months. I mean, the takeaway on that is that it's the same island that Jimmy Choo was born in, or comes from. So, it's sort of coincidence. Yeah, I mean, but what happened is my parents were sent out to Malaysia again when I was sort of 7, 8, 9, and that did have an impact on me because it was sort of, I didn't really have much formal schooling, to be honest, until about the age of 10.
Was there a British school there, Rupert?
No, there was, but it was very sketchy. It was a bit of an outpost for formal curriculum teaching.
And so what do you remember loving as a child? I mean, what were you interested in?
I mean, just the freedom. It was unstructured play was basically what it was all about. I mean, we didn't really wear shoes. I was on the beach a lot, learned how to sort of catch all sorts of animals, be able to sort of, swim daily in the sea. Then I had a water ski. Then I had a sort of, it was a very free time, and for a sort of 7, 8, 9 year old boy, it was heaven.
Yeah.
And then came back to the UK to a very, very freezing cold Fenland school.
Do you remember when you first became aware of fashion or interested in it at all, and particular issues?
I always had this sort of hunch. I can remember when I was even, I was sort of 10, 11, 12. There was a sort of, I just had it was a sort of feeling for the way things looked and the way things were made, and there was nothing specific. I didn't come from a sort of fashion or particularly arty background. I just had a sort of hunch that I liked. I was very sort of like a lot of kids. I think when they get it into their head, they want a certain thing. And it's largely around peer pressure or peer group think, but also that I was slightly ahead of the game, I felt, with things and picking up on things that latterly became sort of the thing to wear. And I used to sort of seek things out.
Was it always shoes, or was it fashion altogether?
No, I mean, it was shoes. I remember almost every pair of shoes I've ever owned. it just happened to have a sort of, it happened to chime with me and what happened is that I didn't go down the sort of creative route in college. I went to university, got a general arts degree, but it wasn't with any view to working in the creative industries. And I was quite curious about the power of commercial creativity, and worked in advertising, but it was sort of, it never felt right. And it was only, but I always still had this feeling for sort of it was fashion, but it was no serious way. Well, I mean, compared to the people who sort of, you know, went to art schools and made it their life, I was completely not of that sort of crowd at all. And it was only sort of as a slight cry for help that I thought, this is miserable. I'm 30 and I sort of hate what I'm doing, that I sort of really dug deep and went and sort of found out about a college in East London that you could learn how to make shoes at. And that's how it started. But so I then went to the age of 31, I think, two. I hadn't designed a single shoe or anything before I was 30.
Were you married at that time, Rupert?
No, I wasn't married. I was you know, single, and it was a great freedom because then obviously I could then explore fully, and I got to Italy and fell in love with being in Italy, and you know, worked with some amazing people there, learnt the language, learnt the way of working in Italian fashion and factories, and that sort of underpins, you know, everything about what I do. There's that sort of small, family run businesses. You know, I worked with Sergio Rossi, and then when in the sort of late noughties, early noughties, sorry, you know, 2000, 2001, when it was a sort of really hot brand, Gianvito was, you know, working as sort of in the PR department, or, you know, he wasn't a designer, but he was working with his dad just sort of on the table next to me. And it was really, you know, and I learned all that sort of how you make shoes and the Italian way from family run businesses.
And did it connect to you immediately? I mean,
yeah,
as much about engineering, I would imagine, as beauty and fashion?
Yeah. I mean, you could see how, you know, from a fairly humble set of, you know, location, people crafted these incredibly beautiful, elegant shoes. And every element of it is actually a really quite a sort of a crunchy industrial process. You know, making heels is like, you know, there's nothing refined about making a very refined heel. It's a piece of rolled steel encased in high density polyurethane. I mean, you know, it's not sexy stuff, but you really need to know how to make those things. Making lasts out of wood and from scratch, making, you know, going to tanneries, seeing actually how leather really is made. What's the difference between a good split of leather and what's a bad split of leather? You know, it's all, each individual stage is very industrial, and that appealed to me, because out of all the, I suppose it's like, you know, architects getting to understand how buildings are made, you know, how bricks are made and how, you know, glass is, you know, it actually, we went to where these places where the component elements are made, it's about as far removed from the end experience of what, you know, of a woman walking into a shop and putting on a pair of my shoes. But that element of it appeals, and I think, you know, I learned from craftsmen rather than fashion types.
Yeah. And so how long were you with Sergio?
Well, initially I was about 18 months. I worked at Bruno Mali, which was a brilliant brand that generation of great Italian shoe brands. I mean, Bruno Mali was sort of most famous for, I think, O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Pair of shoes. Yeah. I mean, actually, they had a pair. No. So, but in fact, they were women's wear. Their women's shoes were brilliant. And the factory was just, it was just the most extraordinary place to work in, because everything was under one roof. And so you learn every single process. And you had access. And it was the kid in a toy shop. I could just, you know, had three people full time looking after the magazine or just the leathers.
Wow.
So yeah, you could just wander around and select any leather you wanted to be able to make a sample or any lasts. And, you know, it's over, you know, for a year, a combination of that and Bruno Mali was a great foundation on which to make, really know how to make beautiful shoes.
And so when did it occur to you that you wanted to do it yourself?
It was after I'd been there. And I think, and then I started to understand the cycle, the fashion cycles, the seasonal cycles. And I realized if I was going to do it, I'd have to get a collection together for the start of the season. And it happened to be, you know, I decided in February, March at the time that I needed to find a factory, and I needed to get a collection ready for when market opened in September. And so, and I thought I'd give it a go, see what happened. If it didn't work, then I'd, you know, have to think again. But I just thought I could, you know, get myself out to America and and present the collection to, you know, in small hotel rooms.
Exactly, the land of the shoe buyers.
Yeah. It was Cynthia Marcus, actually, who gave my first break. I mean, she was probably one of her last seasons, and she was, I mean, it was literally the change down the back of the sofa. That she said, "Well, yeah, right, we'll give this guy a chance." But to me, it was absolutely, my God, they've only gone and bought the shoes, you know, and it was you know, they were in four Neiman's doors the next season.
Wow,
it was extraordinary.
How many styles did you have that first? How many SKUs the first season?
I think I had three. I think three stories of probably I had two or three styles in each because you're funding it from yourself.
Yeah.
You were just trying to, you know, so you got nine or 12 shoes in that there were three stories.
And how did you even know how to sell it? How did you know how to contact?
Again, it's just research.
You made it up.
It was just basically, yeah. I mean, I literally had to just work it all out myself because I had no colleagues or people I'd ever worked with. You know, it was all Italy. It was all about, you know, how the sort of established brands had, you know, been doing it for years. And I really had to work it out. I literally just pick up the phone. I remember phoning someone at Saks, literally just saying, "Can I be put through to the shoe? But what's her name?" You know, his name. Yeah, I got the name and I sort of phoned her. I said, "Hi, you don't know me, but I mean, I've made some shoes and I'd really like to come and show them to you." And she's like, "Really? Oh yeah, I'm actually staying with a friend in New York and I'd just like to come and see." You know, it was like this innocence.
Yeah. And how long until you met Andrew? Because that seemed like it changed.
Well, it changed when, I mean, because we were both doing the trade shows.
He was at Emma Hope, yep. And you must have been across the booth from him.
Exactly.
Because I think that's how I met you.
Yeah. You were buying her shoes. I was still picking up the crumbs from other brands, really, in terms of, you know, the buyers would be coming in and you know, I'd sort of, you know, it would be sweating bullets trying to, you know, because you only have that brief moment. You know, you'd work up that time and you had 4 days at Linea Pelle, or sorry, Premier Class, yeah, in which to sort of sell. And if you didn't get any orders, you know, I mean, that was another. I mean, it was before the pre-season, so you literally had to wait 6 months before the next one came out. So it was quite critical to get, yeah. And, you know, my first season, I remember my first getting there and literally picking up one order in 4 days from some sort of drunk Belgian woman who when I contacted her, had no knowledge that she placed an order.
I think I've seen that woman. I remember a really big milestone after carrying your collection for several years, at least, when you bought your factory.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. And what was that like? And how far along was that?
Well, it was things coming together slightly in the sense that I was so reliant, when you're right at the beginning, when you start out, you're so reliant on the factory being doing what they say they're going to do. Because if you get bumped, it's so easy. When someone's making 500 pairs of shoes for the entire season, it just makes no sense for a factory, because the factory wants high volumes of the same shoe.
Right.
And you're making microscopic runs of lots of complicated shoes. And so it was because I had a relationship and I was out in Italy a lot and I could speak the language and they clearly understood I was serious and desperate, that they took me seriously. I had a very good relationship with the sort of foreman, the shoemaker. And he announced one day that the people who own the factory were having to sell up, you know, a classic Italian story. The tax man had finally caught up with them and they were having to liquidate everything. And he effectively said, "Look, you know, you made them a crazy offer. They probably take it because they got no options." And I was like, "Really? I can barely get from one season to the next. How am I going to buy a factory in Italy?" And anyway, long story, we managed to find a sort of, you know, some soft money and invest someone who'd just come into a bit of money and believed in me. And so between us, we effectively did the due diligence and bought this factory, or bought a controlling interest in the factory. And, you know, it was a big step change. It was the time Andrew joined me. It was the time we got our store in Mayfair. It was a really, you know, it was a really good time. You know, I think independent shoemakers were a real thing. We were ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, the big brands, the clothing brands, the ready-to-wear brands had really got into shoes in quite a big, in quite the way they're in now.
Right.
And so there was a real sense of sort of momentum. And it was, you know, we had some great, great years of, you know, building this factory up and spending lots of time there and, you know, just building the factory and it being this sort of vertical operation, which was, you know, it was exciting.
Did that change sort of the way that you had different responsibilities, I would imagine, at that point as well.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
I mean, you basically had to learn on the job. I mean, because there was no amount of preparation that, you know, you just had to deal with people on a much bigger scale. You had double concerns in the sense you weren't only talking to your own people in London and, you know, Andrew and his team and the shop team and building an e-commerce business, you know, working out how to run, you know, marketing and PR and, you know, trying to build relationships, particularly in the States where we, you know, we hired a PR agency over there, which I worked with very closely for about 3 or 4 years. And then you had this other thing, which was you were responsible for a factory in another language, another culture, another sort of. And so it was great because everything was growing. Everything was on the up. You know, it was all about, you know, how well are we going to do next year, and what can we do, and whether we open stores or where we open stores. So it was exciting, and that's. But
wait, is this pre 2008?
It was pre 2008, and then it sort of hit. But I think we were small enough to sort of, we were on the up enough to weather that.
Yeah.
So we you know, I think a lot of people got caught who had a lot of inventory, or they were, you know, at a different stage of their journey. But we managed to sort of, it was a big bump in the road, but we were sort of going fast enough, I suppose, to sort of get over it. And when we developed a franchise business in Hong Kong, it was very exciting, built around the sort of Pebble idea and sort of gilding and, you know, making very sort of really high end shoes. I mean, we got to a point where these were sort of like, they were almost like pieces of jewelry, this market. And we were working very closely with a partner who had very big ambitions to roll this out into mainland China. And the point, you know, so that was all going on as well.
Yeah. And then, speaking of owning a factory, talk to me a little bit about the pandemic and sort of how that affected your factory and your business and how you got through it.
Well, I mean, it couldn't have been designed better to screw up a luxury shoe business. Because
yes.
Particularly someone that had a big exposure to Hong Kong and China.
Right.
We were making between 12 and 15,000 pairs of shoes a year for that market. And then we were manufacturing in Italy, which was the first European country to shut down, we had stores and staff on, you know, long-term contracts in the UK. So all these things were sort of very, very difficult. But through a series of good luck and, I don't know, the gods sort of shining, looking down on us, we managed to sort of get through that. And there was, you know, the core team were amazing. And we managed to shave things down and get back to the essence of what we were sort of all about. And the factory, we managed to sort of save the factory through a good fortune. And I managed to sell the factory to someone who is a very, very good, was an experienced sort of factory owner who, you know, has a, you know, there was a very smart, so I became, rather than being responsible for a, you know, workforce and a factory, I've become the customer, or, you know, as I was in the first place. So I've suddenly become this red carpet customer overnight from this like hat
VIP
owner that, you know, was. So yeah, so it was a sort of nice sobering experience, but, you know, we came through it.
Well, I think also one of the strangest things was your collection was one of the strongest that I saw in the entire market post pandemic. It was so beautiful, sparkling, joyful, but also really the essence of what you do. It looked like Rupert from when I first saw it that first time.
Yeah,
I mean, well,
that's lovely to hear, because you know, and we really had to sort of pull out the stops to make it work, because we were working incredibly sort of restricted ways, because we couldn't travel. I couldn't travel to Italy as freely as I wanted to. We were having to do everything on Zoom and, you know, DHL and, you know, just, you know, we were on sort of WhatsApp messaging and, you know, I did an entire collection without ever going to the factory, and that was one of the post-pandemic collections. Was like, wow, it's here, and I literally had nothing physically to do. You know, I've had to sort of dig deep into the archive, referencing what I was doing, you know, other, you know, so yeah, revisiting the handwriting rather than coming up with anything absolutely brand new structure, new development. So it was a case of just, I suppose, really just sort of revisiting my what I did what I was known for, I suppose. You know, a sufficiently deep archive now for me to know, confidently go back and, you know, look again.
What is your life like outside of work? I know you have a lot of little boys.
It's quite relentless. I mean, it's it's you know, I think because I've done so much time, so to speak, in the business, that there are certain shorthands I can use to get things done efficiently, which allows me to be able to sort of be a present parent, because I know fashion's pretty unsympathetic to that family life. But I suppose I've designed it probably by accident more than design to be able to do both without compromise.
How do you make the space to be inspired, to find inspiration?
I mean, one of the great things about fashion, the fashion calendar, is that, you know, it's a calendar. You have to do certain things at certain times of the year, otherwise you miss the market. So it's useful. It's like you're working to deadlines, and so you just put your diary together and you carve out thinking time at specific times of the year, and you stick to that. You know, the it's relentless. You're doing four collections a year. You know, there are certain periods of the year where that's all I do, which is design. But it may be for an intense period of time. But I won't. But I'm not doing anything else.
Right.
So I can work for 2 weeks solidly on a collection, and actually that's a lot of time. If you're working with a really tight team that know exactly what you're talking about and referencing, you know, existing structures, existing techniques, existing, you know, vocabulary, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every season. And also you can't really, because you've got a sort of signature look, or what you're known for. You can't deviate too much from that. On the core collection, obviously you're expected to do things that, you know, that sort of add interest and show you've got sort of creative spark, and you can tell stories in a different way. But you can't, we read put the archive together again in the summer. There's just under 2,000 different shoe designs that I've got. And so, you know, as an archive, to actually just go through that is a real luxury, to sort of revisit things that I did 12 years ago. It's what, you know, it's what the houses do at the moment. You know, that you get a new creative director into, you know, Bauman or whatever. They just go through the archive.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, I do it in a sort of miniature way. You know, that's what I do. And so that speeds things up.
Yeah.
We know what works. We know our customer. We know we can be a little more precise about what we're doing. We're not trying to sort of boost the business threefold because someone has bought it.
Right.
You know, there is a very sort of dedication. Again, it comes back to that sort of old school learning that I had when these privately owned, family-run Italian shoe businesses. That sort of underpins really my attitude to you know, how I work, because I know no different. I've never worked for a large, you know, private, you know, whatever, you know, corporately owned company that's got shareholders breathing down your neck, and, you know, expectations, partnerships that, you know, drive them, commercials of it. It is a sort of, you know, it's a modest but highly creative little business.
It's a mighty little business. Do you have do you have a favorite failure?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's endless failure. Really. That's sort of what you're dealing with. You know, I think if you come up, you design something, the potency of the idea sort of suddenly overwhelms you to start with. You think that's a great. That's sort of, you know, I love that. I mean, I remember, you know, on a very, very small scale, doing this, all this bamboo story. Now, I thought it was a really lovely idea. We made these leather, we got it stamped, we got it cropped, we got it made into to look like bamboo.
Yeah.
And of course, and literally, we didn't sell a stick. No one got it.
I think you bought the
first round, which is the second round when I really inflated it all and made it sort of supersized. And then literally, Andrew, I was like, yeah, let's use it. Let's use this. This is the poster child of the campaign. You know, it's going to go mad. People are going to think I'm a genius. And yet, you know, it's like not a single person picked it up.
You're ahead of your time.
Well, you know, it's just, But that on a sort of product level, it happens all the time, because you always think, God, we've cracked it, we've really cracked it, and then the world's just not like that. But I think serious failures, I think just coming through stuff that hasn't worked or hasn't worked as well as we hoped is the sort of most successful failure. It's just how you react. Nothing's a failure in its sense that it's a sort of full stop. It's just like, oh, well, we can't do that, or we won't do that again. We'll do it differently. And so, I think the danger is if you think it's an outright failure, you just think, well, there's no way out of this. It's failed. I mean, obviously, if the bank manager just turns up and says, we want all our money back, then probably that's the sort of end of the line. But that hasn't happened yet. So,
what are you most proud of in what you've created in this career?
I think quite frankly, being independent and being, still doing what I did 20 years ago in pretty much the same form is the thing I'm most proud of. I mean, I can still, funnily enough, I've just been in Notting Hill. I'm just wandering around. Fridays, I tend to just go off and just look at stuff. And it's great. There's a great sort of flea market. But they have a couple of stalls there. And one of the things is secondhand. And it's always quite fun to go in and just look through all these designer brands and try and find your own shoes in amongst all the Balenciagas and Pradas and stuff. And because I have to manage my sort of ego and expectations quite carefully, because if I wander in and there's a load of shoes, the brands, I think, who the hell are they? Why am I here? And that's why I keep rummaging and I get further, deeper and deeper into the store until eventually, there I am, Rupert Sanson. I'm still alive.
I think it's the opposite, actually. I think that you probably won't find a lot of your shoes there because people keep them because they're so comfortable and they're so beautiful.
Very flattering.
Very honest.
Well, thank you. But I did. But well, best of both worlds. I found just enough
okay, good.
To keep my ego.
Okay, good.
In check. In check.
Did you have a prom? Do you have proms at your boarding school in England?
Not in quite the same way.
Okay.
I mean, surprise, surprise, I organised one.
Okay.
I hired a boat and got everyone together and we dressed up and sailed down the river through Cambridge on this extraordinary boat called the Viscountess Berry, and we had a jazz band.
And what did you wear?
Probably some terrible pink bow tie and stuff. I probably dressed like some terrible 50-year-old man, thinking I was really, really sophisticated.
And what shoes?
What shoes? Good question. What shoes? I would have probably worn some black. I would have tried to be really grown up about it all and not cool. I'd just been like, something I'm James Bond, what would he wear? It would have been some black shiny shoes to go with my pink bow tie.
I love it. Rupert, thank you so much.
Thank you. What's up? See you. Bye. Bye.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drasda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.